The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're heading over to Oprah Daily in the Relationships section. Our first article is How I Healed My Inner Teenager. It took a decade of mentoring high schoolers to recognize that I didn't need to apologize for existing. And this article is by Chelsea Gordon. I'm so sorry. Can I go to the bathroom? 16-year-old Abby looks at me with a disciplined sweetness. I've been tutoring her in AP U.S. history for the past hour, and we had come to a natural pause. With heartfelt curiosity, I ask, I get that you want to be polite by asking, but you're not interrupting, so I'm wondering, why are you sorry? I have been tutoring and mentoring teenage girls for over a decade, so I was extremely used to girls apologizing for needing to go to the bathroom. But weirdly, it wasn't until this moment that I ever thought to question it. Abby's large brown eyes reflect deeply on the question. I don't want to be annoying. She struggles, trying to find more words. I don't know, it just seems like the right thing to say. So you're pre-apologizing for being potentially annoying? For doing something that's normal and necessary human behavior? Abby sheepishly smiles. Yeah. And you feel like people expect you to say sorry like this? Definitely. When else are you worried about being annoying? Abby scrunches her face as thoughts flood her brain. Well, there's so many. Like, if a boy answers a question wrong in class, I don't raise my hand to give the right answer. My heart twists in pain, remembering how I used to do the exact same thing. My fear of being called a know-it-all kept me from raising my hand. It kept me silent. A few days after Abby's bathroom apology, I find myself accidentally knocking over a display of deodorant at the drugstore. A flurry of sorries pour out of my mouth to shoppers walking by, even though absolutely none of them are inconvenienced by my clumsiness. I tell Abby about my unnecessary sorries when I see her next, and she bluntly reflects back to me, "So it never ends, does it?" I stressfully rub my forehead, wanting to model something better for her. But all teenage girls have ever wanted from me is the truth, so I vulnerably search within. It feels like there's still a teenage girl inside of me who wants people to like her. Abby is intrigued. The teenage girl inside of you? Yeah. It's becoming clear that my perfectionism and people-pleasing started when I was around your age. And I think my inner teenage girl is still scared of being judged. Abby nods her head in agreement. It's understandable because we are indeed judged. Her insight changes my attention. She's right. In my work with teenage girls, I've constantly witnessed how they're unfairly judged by both men and women as emotional, dramatic, mean, and crazy when they choose to speak up in a manner that's different from the well-rehearsed, nice and polite show. And when I observe similar behavior from boys, they do not get judged with words that have the same negative connotations. I can think of so many instances that followed me into adulthood when, out of fear of being given these labels, I made myself small and silent, which brings me to the number one thing I always tell my therapist. I can't believe I'm still dealing with this stuff. There's a lot of discussion in the mental health space these days around healing your inner child. But what I'm realizing sitting there, seeing so much of myself in Abby's struggles, is that I need to heal my inner teenage girl. Adolescence was a completely different developmental stage for me, and it was when I first felt the silencing effect of judgment and expectations. Life was now, thankfully, putting me into environments that reflected the very healing I needed myself, and I needed to listen. 15-year-old Keisha told me she was scared of being called bossy when she was planning a party and needed to give instructions to people helping her. 16-year-old Olivia told me she hates being called too intense and too opinionated when she dares to share her political beliefs with her grandfather. And the pattern I noticed is that when these girls feel those judgy labels descending upon them, they quickly said, sorry. In those moments, I could see a girl's body fold into something smaller, trying to make herself agreeable. The weight of hearing girls similar stories over and over again, feeling as if they needed to apologize for being themselves, built up inside of me until I broke. And one night, I found myself crying in the bathtub, dictating a voice note into my phone. These are stories someone else is telling us, but we can choose our own story. Floating in water without shame and without apologizing, I asked the know-it-all girl inside of me to speak. My fear of judgment had kept her silent. But you know who responded? A girl who is really smart. My inner teenage girl read a lot, studied, asked questions, and worked hard. She should have been raising her hand because guess what? She knew the answers. I had been feeling confused because the story I was telling myself was that my inner teenage girl was the insecure part of me. But amidst disintegrating bubbles and my frustrated tears, I could see clearly. It was society's labels that were creating the insecurity. I can't control the fact that people are judgy, but I can control what power they have over me. I took my inner teenage girl's answers back to the girls I was working with, because I realized that I needed to give them agency. I needed to give them power over their own story. So when those societal judgments appeared, I asked the girls to reframe the moment in a way that felt truthful and empowering to them. Keisha told me that instead of believing she's bossy, she could choose the story that she's a natural leader who's smart to delegate. Riley reframed the situation as society's problem and how it teaches boys to sexualize girls' bodies, and she began to tell the story that her body isn't the problem. Olivia told me that she could choose to believe her political opinions intense because they addressed urgent and vital issues. With each new response, I became more and more inspired by their very bold, wise, and powerful perspectives. So much so that I expanded my own sense of agency and wrote a book, Underestimated the Wisdom and Power of Teenage Girls. Abby recently asked me, "How's your inner teenage girl doing?" I smiled. Guess what she does? She goes to the bathroom whenever she wants, and she doesn't apologize for it. Abby laughs. What? I like her. So then is she healed? I meet eyes with her. Turns out she wasn't broken. I just needed to give her a voice. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We're moving over to Oprah's intention section. Oprah and Dr. Vivek Murthy on the antidote to loneliness. If you're sitting at home and you're feeling alone, the best way to alleviate that is to figure out how to do something for somebody else. This article is by Oprah Winfrey. Oprah: I'm here in my garden at the tea house in California on a bright, sunny day in December. We still have roses in December. Dr. Vivek Murthy: That's extraordinary. Oprah: I am with Dr. Vivek Murthy, who is the U.S. Surgeon General, and he's written a book called Together, The healing power of human connection is a sometimes lonely world. And we just finished doing a podcast here at the Tea House about loneliness. And you said something that I know is the secret, the cure to not feeling as lonely. You said the antidote to loneliness is, Dr. Murthy, service. Oprah, service? Dr. Murthy, yes. Oprah. And being able to do something for somebody else. So if you're sitting at home and you're feeling, particularly during these holiday season, that you're alone, the best way to alleviate that is to figure out how to do something for somebody else, right? Dr. Murthy, that's exactly right. Oprah, and it doesn't have to be big. Dr. Murthy, it doesn't have to be big. Small acts of service. Oprah, small acts of service. Like what? Give an example. Dr. Murthy, like knowing that a friend is having a hard time, just giving them a call to check in on them. Seeing that your neighbor may be having a tough time cleaning up their leaves and just spending 5 minutes to give them a hand. Dropping off, you know, a cake to someone or, you know, some food. Knowing that they're just having a busy, busy time, you know, with their family. These are small things that can really help people recognize that they're seen, that they're not alone. Small things like these. Oprah, I like that. So I think for this week, that's actually a nice intention, a good one, a strong one. What can you do to reach out to somebody else to do just a small thing? Because that's where it counts. Over in Culture, News, and Books, Oprah announces her 110th book club pick. I truly think that it's the most important book I've ever read, says Oprah of her latest selection. This article is by Charlie Burlock. Since 1996, Oprah has chosen 109 unique book club picks to read and discuss with her community. For her 110th selection, for the first time in history, she chose the same book twice. Originally published in 2005 and selected for the book club in 2008, A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle is the most important book she's ever read, and it's safe to say she reads a lot. When she picked the title as her 61st book club pick, she had never recommended a book in the spiritual or self-help genre before. It changed the way I looked at pain in my life. It changed the way I looked at ego in my life. It changed the way I looked at the roles I played in my life versus the values that I hold for myself. Oprah explains in the video below, I already had a life's purpose in 2008, but it enhanced the purpose that I was living here on Earth, and I know it can do it for everyone who reads it. It's hard to imagine a better endorsement than that. This is the second selection in the new collaboration between Oprah's Book Club and Starbucks. The partnership offers the same must-read book club recommendations from Oprah, along with newly formatted author interviews and official Starbucks beverage pairings for each monthly pick. A New Earth's subtitle is Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, and its pairing ensures that you will be revved up and ready. The Starbucks Cortado combines three shots of Ristretto Starbucks and Blonde Espresso with steamed whole milk, an eye-opening drink for this eye-opening read. Oprah sat down with Eckhart Tolle, that last name is spelled T-O-L-L-E, and a live audience at the Starbucks Reserve Store in New York's Empire State Building to discuss A New Earth and its vital lessons for 2025. You can watch the conversation now for free on Oprah's YouTube channel. You can also listen to it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Even if you have already read the book, it's worth revisiting. Oprah herself always keeps a copy on her nightstand to constantly give herself a refresher course. You can also brush up on the book's teachings through the 10-part Oprah's Super Soul podcast series. A New Earth, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, in which Oprah and Eckhart break down each chapter and answer readers' questions. We cannot wait to hear how a new earth resonates with you in this new year. And the book, Penguin Life, A New Earth by Eckhart, that's spelled E-C-K-H-A-R-T, Toll, T-O-L-L-E, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose. The book is $10 at Amazon and $18 at Macy's. Okay, we're heading over to the wholeness section. For instant relief from anxiety, try this exercise. This 5-minute routine from Martha Beck's latest book will stop any spiral. This article is by Martha Beck. I was about 5 years old when I first entered a shell of mirrors at an amusement park. I was not amused. To my eyes, the hall, actually just a small room, looked like a horrifying alien universe. The walls, ceiling, and floor were covered with mirrors that were warped to create grotesque reflections. Since every mirror reflected the other mirrors, the room also appeared endless. Terrified by all the monstrous images, I got so disoriented that I couldn't find the exit. Fortunately, a friend pulled me out of that awful little room. But later, on my occasions, I got trapped in a metaphorical hall of mirrors that materialized from the anxious reflections of my brain's left hemisphere, which is responsible for analytical, logical, and verbal thinking. You may have experienced the same thing, because the anxiety spiral, just like a carnivalesque hall of mirrors, is structured in a way that makes it hard for us to find the exit. The anxiety-producing part of the brain magnifies its own distorted thinking while denying that anything else exists. Once we're inside the left hemisphere's hall of mirrors, that is our anxiety, simple kindness may look like a manipulative lie. Rest and relaxation appear weak. Optimism is stupid. Everything is out to get us, except for the things we want, which seems to be in terribly short supply. There's never enough good stuff in the world as seen from this mental perspective. Never enough money, status, power, love, golden toilets, breakfast cereal, anything. This perspective makes the world look grim and joyless, but by God, it feels real. Because the negativity bias and the hall of mirrors affect the way we identify what's true, anxiety can blind us to inconsistencies or errors in our own thinking. So how do we find the way out? By recognizing the sensation of suffering. Seeing the world from the inside, the anxiety spiral feels horrible, but we can use that horrible feeling as a signal. Hello, you're being spun by your own negativity bias. You are lost in the hall of mirrors. Once we realize this, we can step into a better mindset. How can we reestablish a more balanced worldview? By activating our right hemisphere, which is more attuned to sense perceptions, emotions, and intuition. In fact, you can do that right now with this simple exercise. Just grab a pen and a piece of paper. Number one, first, think about something that makes you mildly anxious. Not anything truly horrifying, but a situation that makes you a bit nervous, like remembering to buy a gift for a relative or file your taxes on time. Notice how this mild anxiety feels in your body and emotions. Describe it. Number two. Now, let that thought go for just a minute. Instead, think about three things you love to taste. Imagine tasting them. List them. Number three. Now list three things you love to hear. Imagine hearing. Number four. Now list three things you love to see. Picture them as you write them down. Number five. Now list three things you love to smell. Remember the scents. Number six. Now list three things you love to feel against your skin. Imagine touching them. Number 7. Next, see if you can remember or imagine a scenario in which all or most of the items above are present. Because each person's brain is unique, some people find it easier to remember an experience, whereas others can easily conjure sensations through imagination. If neither imagination nor memory works for you, think of a place where you can assemble some things you love with each of your senses. Then spend time in that place, focused on sensing each object. Right now, or whenever you can bring these sense perceptions into your mind, write a brief description of the scenario that combines some of your favorite sense perceptions. As you do this, use present tense language. Include at least one image from each of your 5 senses. For example, I'm sitting in my favorite easy chair, sipping champagne and munching on Belgian chocolate. My cat is purring on my lap while I stroke her fur. Outside, I can see a beautiful forest and my children playing. I can hear their laughter, wind in the trees and birds singing. A cool breeze drifts through the open window, carrying the scent of pine trees and the ocean. Also, I am receiving the best foot massage of my life. Number 1. Briefly describe the physical and emotional sensations that arose as you composed this fantasy situation. Number 2. Notice what happened to your anxiety during the time you were composing, experiencing, and writing about this scene. If you actually did the exercise above, that is, if you really spent some time imagining, remembering, or experiencing all these lovely sense impressions, I hope you enjoyed your brief vacation from anxiety. But it's more likely you read the instructions and thought, okay, right, got it, I see where this is going. After all, that's what you've been trained to do. Our culture is dominated by the verbal, analytical thinking most prominent in the brain's left hemisphere. So we're conditioned to believe that reading about an experience or thinking about it in words is the same thing as living it. In essence, you've been trained to believe that thinking is superior to experiencing. So maybe you dismissed the whole exercise above as stupid, basic, or unimportant. Perhaps you filled in the blanks, felt your anxiety diminish for a few seconds, and then mentally invalidated the whole experience. Well, sure, that was nice, but it was just something I dreamed up in my imagination. It isn't real. But guess what? That's exactly the same thing you're doing when you see the world as frightening and unsafe. When the brain's left hemisphere throws us into the hall of mirrors, we're primed to believe that our perceptions are factually correct. By contrast, when we use our right hemispheres to assemble an internal experience, we know this is a choice. If you can trace the anxiety spiral in your own mind and life, if you can step away from it for even a second or two, you're already leaving that shrunken, contorted world behind. Bon voyage. So the book that accompanies this article is called Beyond Anxiety, Curiosity, Creativity, and Finding Your Life's Purpose. And it's by Martha Beck, B-E-C-K. It's $21 at Amazon and $27 at Barnes & Noble. We're back over in the relationships section with this article. Here's why 50% of Gen Zers say they feel unprepared for life after college. A groundbreaking new book shows us why the education system is failing our youth. Spoiler alert, it's not all about smartphones and what parents can do about it starting right now. This article is by Jennifer Anderson and Rebecca Winthrop. Amina, a radiant, talkative, funny 20-year-old Nigerian-American at a top Ivy League college, was that kid in her Atlanta private school. straight-A student, student council president, mock trial president, athlete, soccer, rowing, basketball. She was a checkout worker at Chick-fil-A and a member of the Coder School, an after-school program to build coding and character skills. She volunteered for a church group serving HIV+ individuals and a nonprofit that helps low-income immigrant families get settled. Coming in 14 hours short of earning a Presidential Service Award, which requires 100 hours. By her own account, she loved it all. I love praise. I loved being praised. So I really loved being called out by my teachers for being so smart, for being so diligent, she told us in our research for our new book, The Disengaged Teen. Amina applied to 10 colleges and got into every one. But if high school wasn't that hard for her, college was. There was a lot of very smart people, and her classes were significantly more challenging. She was majoring in computer science and struggled mightily with math. Homework assignments took way longer than before. At sea, with new feelings of uncertainty and self-doubt, she started to check out. By sophomore year, she was close to failing out. I didn't know what to do, she says, and I didn't want to seek help because it felt like I was admitting that I had a problem, and smart kids don't have problems. Now, there are millions of kids like Amina in the world presenting parents with an unusual quandary we call the achiever conundrum, the frustrating reality that something we all want for our kids, a strong work ethic and taking pride in what they do, can also harm them when taken to an extreme. For 3 years, we spoke to parents and adolescents about their experiences with learning, and we identified 4 modes of learning that teens fall into. Those coasting along during the bare minimum are in passenger mode. Those withdrawing and acting out are in register mode. Kids like Amina, who knock it out of the park but become fragile learners, exemplify achiever mode. And those who dig into things they love and make things happen are in explorer mode. Parents and teachers typically love kids in achiever mode. These students nail the grades, pile on the extracurriculars, and are often laser-focused on getting into an elite college. All things that reflect well on parents and teachers alike. But while plenty of kids operate in healthy achiever mode, a shockingly high number are unhappy and at risk of burnout. In The Disengaged Teen, we write a length about one well-designed longitudinal study from 2013. It showed that kids who were cognitively engaged in school but not emotionally engaged, for example, they worked hard and dug in but didn't always see the point or enjoy it, had the greatest level of depressive symptoms. They were even more depressed than those who were totally disengaged from learning. We call these kids unhappy achievers, and we're not alone in worrying about them. In 2019, a study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine added kids in high-achieving schools to their list of at-risk groups, along with kids living in poverty and foster care, recent immigrants, and those with incarcerated parents. The culprit was the pressure, not the schools themselves. High-achieving schools are filled with children in achiever mode. Kids who spend too much time in this mode often tie their self-worth to their academic or sporting or musical achievements. Because they don't want to fall from their perch, they don't take risks and can stumble mightily when setbacks come, as they always do eventually. Because Amina was at college when this happened, she could keep it from her parents, and she did. They had always treasured her gold stars, so how could she let them down? So what can parents of high-achieving kids do to help them buffer the negative effects of all-out achiever mode and make sure they develop explorer mode muscles? Number 1, encourage small risks to build resilient learning muscles. Amina told us she wished she had failure therapy in high school, so it wasn't such a blow to her sense of self when she experienced failure in college. To that end, suggest that your high achiever take the interesting class, not the one that's guaranteed A. Talk to your kids about the little failures you had throughout your day or week and how you recovered. This goes a long way in helping them see how to be resilient. If a B or C rolls in, explain that struggle is part of learning, that taking on hard things can be good, and you are in it together. Number 2, encourage radical downtime to reflect and recharge. This term was coined by William Stixrud, that's Stixrud, and Ned Johnson, the authors of The Self-Driven Child, and it means doing nothing purposeful, nothing that requires highly focused thought. For kids in achiever mode, this can be critical to pausing the frantically turning wheels. We both set limits on our kids' phone use and make sure they have some time at the dinner table, taking walks, playing with the dog, when they can recharge without an agenda. Other parents we interviewed discouraged their kids from joining travel sports teams outside of school to ensure the family still had time together. Number 3, enforce strict bedtimes. No, really. Over half of middle school students and over 70% of high school students do not get the 8 to 10, 12 hours of sleep they need. This is a full 5-alarm fire for education experts. Lack of sleep seriously messes with brain function, including essential building blocks of learning, memory, information processing, attention, and problem solving. When we encourage our kids to close the computer and get some rest, even if there's more work to be done, it communicates that we care more about their well-being than their grades. Consider the cost of all that achieving. Is it worth it? Focus on your kids' long-term growth as people, not their short-term outcomes on a test. Ultimately, we want our kids to know how to live a productive and happy life. That includes self-care and the self-awareness to be able to ask themselves, what do I like? And what do I need? Achiever mode kids in particular need help with this. Amina had to take a year off from college. She worked in a nonprofit startup, which meant figuring things out on the fly, a deeply uncomfortable experience for someone who likes knowing she's doing things right. She returned to college less focused on graduating at the top of her class and more focused on enjoying her classes and extracurriculars. She's building explorer muscles while still spending plenty of time in achiever mode. The greatest gift we can give as parents is to nudge our teens toward experiences and opportunities that help them understand who they are and who they hope to be. Yes, grades and achieving are part of this, but nurturing a robust learner identity, that is, developing a sense of self separate from external accolades, is equally, if not more, important. The real goal is not the brand name college or the perfect resume. It's kids feeling prepared to navigate a messy, fast-changing world. We're over in the word of the week. Monotasking. Stop multitasking, it doesn't work. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Monotasking. It's January, time to embody a more productive, organized version of yourself who can do it all and have it all. Or is it? Before you whip yourself into a frenzy and set yourself up for burnout, consider a new tactic that is actually more productive, monotasking. Monotasking sounds almost too simple. Just focus on one thing at a time. But we're guessing you haven't done it in a couple of decades, probably, and thanks to our eroded attention spans, it might actually feel really difficult, says Thatcher Wine, author of The 12 Monotasks, in this Oprah Daily story. Once Wine managed to dive into a single thing instead of everything, he realized he was able to really, truly give it his full attention. In return, he experienced more clarity, stronger focus, and higher productivity. Ready to try? Wine has a few tips, like pausing the podcast or show you always have on in the background, and reading physical books. A few more prompts. Stare at one screen rather than toggling between two. Stop finishing this one last email while talking to a loved one. And complete one task before starting another. Checking it off your list will feel good, and expanding your attention span again will feel great. This next article is in the wellness section. How to find the joy in dry January. When the author quit drinking at 19, she expected sobriety to be hard. Instead, her world came into beautiful focus. This article is by Ava Robinson. Every year, around this time, people try to give up alcohol for 1 month for dry January. My social media feed becomes inundated with people talking about strategies, why it got too hard, or how they were perfect except for that one office party. I get it. I really do. There's a memory I have. It was summer. I was 17. And even when I was living it, I was aware that it would be one of the best days of my life. My friends and I packed up our bikinis and our backpacks and took the F train to the last stop, Coney Island, after school. We bought yardsticks, sweet rum slushies sold to anyone, no matter their age, and drank them as we made friends with strangers in that way that only seems possible when inhibitions are lowered. I swam out into the ocean, far enough to get past the garbage that bobbed in the surf, and floated there, the world suddenly quiet. There was sun on my face, a buzz in my veins, friends on the beach, and I didn't think anything could get better. I got sober at 19, and although I was immediately glad that I wasn't forgetting what happened the night before, and my phone wasn't filled with angry messages from friends about how I'd hooked up with the wrong guy and thrown up in the cab, I wasn't sure how I was supposed to have fun like this. To my surprise, my grandfather, who was 64 years older than me and had been sober longer than I'd been alive, helped me find that giddy, joyful exuberance again as a sober adult. My granddad, Charlie, was not the best father. He left my mother and her two siblings when they were young children, moved from Philadelphia to New York City, and lived from drink to drink in Greenwich Village. It was the 60s, and he had wild stories about brushing up against Nina Simone and Miles Davis at late-night clubs. He rarely told these stories, and especially not in front of my mother. If he did, her face would sour, and later she'd say to me, "And where was I when he was doing all that?" It was a rhetorical question. She was 100 miles away, under the care of a single mother who had a drinking problem of her own, and struggled to make ends meet without any financial support from her ex-husband. But then, when he was in his 40s and his children were young adults, a doctor told him if he didn't quit drinking, he would die of cirrhosis. So, with much effort, some time in a men's home in Hoboken, and the support of AA, he quit and became the man I knew, a good grandfather and a very good friend. It was isolating to be in my early 20s and sober. I worked at a museum gift shop, and the other young people I worked with went out to bars when we were done with our shifts. I was rarely invited, and usually I didn't go with them. It got back to me that one of the girls who organized these get-togethers said, "I would have invited Ava, but she doesn't drink." I wasn't sure she was worried for my comfort or her own, but I certainly would have been uncomfortable in a bar. Publicly, not drinking required such immediate intimacy. People were curious why I wasn't ordering a beer with them, and my choice was either to lie or to tell them something deeply personal about my struggles with addiction. I didn't want to do either. So instead, I found refuge at Granddad's apartment. We watched old movies, discussed history, and learned to make ice cream. To him, fun wasn't lowered inhibitions, but a mind that was sharp enough to grasp every detail. We rarely talked about drinking because we didn't need to. There was so much else to do, see, and discuss. There was so much that I hadn't noticed before. On Friday nights, we'd go to the Metropolitan Museum's extended hours. At first, I was reluctant to leave the house. I had been to the museum 100 times. There was nothing fun that I hadn't already seen. But weaving through the exhibits, he'd always find a way to convince me otherwise. He didn't just glance around a room, but stopped to look closely and read the plaques. It says here, the cows in the background are youthful, but they just look happy to me. What do you think? I'd stop with him and look closely at smiling cows in an 18th century Indian painting I otherwise would have walked right past. Spending so much time with my granddad helped me see how sobriety created more room to find joy everywhere in everything, especially in the little particularities of life that alcohol blurred away. He became an insect photographer, spending his days in Central Park snapping pictures of the remarkable amount of biodiversity living there, right under the rest of the city's nose. He had thousands of photos of wasps, and he could zoom in to find the subtle characteristics that differentiated one species from another. 2 yellow stripes across a black body instead of 3. I'd watch him as he figured it out, finger brushing over the screen, mouth mumbling the Latin name, my presence beside him entirely forgotten. The correct discovery bringing a broad smile to his face, and then immediately more questions and more curiosity. I emulated the way he lived a sober life and tried to live in the details, too. When I think of the most fun I'd ever had, those hazy days at the beach when I was a teenager aren't the first that come to mind. Instead, I think of a more recent summer day. I was 29 years old and 10 years sober. My husband and I arrived at the cabin we regularly rent on the West Branch Delaware River to find the water rushing where it usually dribbled. It was deep enough to actually swim in. Sobriety changes us, but not completely. Swimming is, and always has been, my favorite thing to do. When I think about that day, I remember the rough brush of the sweet Joe Pye weed that dotted the riverbank, a native plant favored by swallowtails, something I learned from my granddad. The sharp prick of pebbles between my toes. How the water was clouded, and I could feel the grains of the swallowed riverbanks against the smooth skin of my thighs. The sounds of my husband's laughter mixing with the rush of the water and the ring of birdsong. Alcohol makes us exuberant. It lowers our inhibitions and helps us say or do things we'd normally be too afraid to, but I don't think it brings true joy or makes our life more magical. This can be a hard thing to learn, especially within 1 month. But even in a short time period, sobriety sharpens us to the world, and because of that, it sharpens what makes us happy, too. Those moments in the river are some of my most treasured because I was alive to all the details. If I zoom out to that time in my day, away from that one special moment of that one special day, it was certainly not a happy time. It was a short trip upstate. I'd spent the past few months visiting my granddad, not in his apartment, but in the hospital room we both knew he'd never leave. Driving down the next day, my husband dropped me off there. I sat with Granddad, scent of the river water still on my skin, and spoke to him for the last time. A few days later, he lost consciousness. 2 weeks after that, he passed away. There's a world in which I felt guilty for going away at all, or where the grief of knowing I was about to lose someone so special tainted everything around me, where the swallowtails and sweet Joe Pye weed became invisible, and my mind stayed in the hospital room with him. But after so long tuning into the world, watching and feeling everything around me, that was impossible. I couldn't ignore the joy of being with my husband and the beauty of the nature around us, or the fun of splashing in the river. Over in culture and news and books, read this excerpt from Oprah's favorite chapter of A New Earth. This is what I believe. If you didn't read another page, that if you just read chapter 3 in this book, it could really transform your life, says Oprah. And this article is by Eckhart Tolle. Most people are so completely identified with the voice in the head, the incessant stream of involuntary and compulsive thinking, and the emotions that accompany it, that we may describe them as being possessed by their mind. As long as you are completely unaware of this, you take the thinker to be who you are. This is the egoic mind. We call it egoic because there is a sense of self, of I, ego, in every thought, every memory, every interpretation, opinion, viewpoint, reaction, emotion. This is unconsciousness, spiritually speaking. Your thinking, the content of your mind, is of course conditioned by the past, your upbringing, culture, family background, and so on. The central core of all your mind activity consists of certain repetitive and persistent thoughts, emotions, and reactive patterns that you identify with most strongly. This entity is the ego itself. In most cases, when you say, I, it is the ego speaking, not you, as we have seen. It consists of thought and emotion, of a bundle of memories you identify with as me and my story, of habitual roles you play without knowing it, of collective identifications such as nationality, religion, race, social class, or political allegiance. It also contains personal identifications, not only with possessions, but also with opinions, external appearance, long-standing resentments, or concepts of yourself as better than or not as good as others, as a success or failure. The content of the ego varies from person to person, but in every ego, the same structure operates. In other words, egos only differ on the surface. Deep down, they are all the same. In what way are they the same? They live on identification and separation. When you live through the mind made, self-comprised of thought and emotion that is the ego, the basis for your identity is precarious because thought and emotion are by their very nature ephemeral, fleeting. So every ego is continuously struggling for survival, trying to protect and enlarge itself. To uphold the I thought, it needs the opposite thought of the other. The conceptual I cannot survive without the conceptual other. The others are most other when I see them as my enemies. At one end of the scale of this unconscious egoic pattern lies the egoic compulsive habit of fault-finding and complaining about others. Jesus referred to it when he said, "Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye?" At the other end of the scale, there is physical violence between individuals, warfare between nations. In the Bible, Jesus' question remains unanswered, but the answer is, of course, because when I criticize or condemn another, it makes me feel bigger and superior. Complaining and resentment. Complaining is one of the ego's favorite strategies for strengthening itself. Every complaint is a little story the mind makes up that you completely believe in. Whether you complain aloud or only in thought makes no difference. Some egos that perhaps don't have much else to identify with easily survive on complaining alone. When you are in the grip of such an ego, complaining, especially about other people, is habitual and, of course, unconscious, which means you don't know what you are doing. Applying negative mental labels to people, either to their face or more commonly when you speak about them to others, or even just think about them, is often part of this pattern. Name-calling is the crudest form of such labeling, and of the ego's need to be right and triumph over others. On the next level down on the scale of unconsciousness, you have shouting and screaming, and not much below that, physical violence. Resentment is the emotion that goes with complaining and the mental labeling of people and adds even more energy to the ego. Resentment means to feel bitter, indignant, aggrieved, or offended. You resent other people's greed, their dishonesty, their lack of integrity, what they are doing, what they did in the past, what they said, what they failed to do, what they should or shouldn't have done. The ego loves it. Instead of overlooking unconsciousness in others, you make it into their identity. Who is doing that? The unconsciousness in you, the ego. Sometimes the fault that you perceive in another isn't even there. It is a total misinterpretation, a projection by a mind conditioned to see enemies and to make itself right or superior. At other times, the fault may be there, but by focusing on it, sometimes to the exclusion of everything else, you amplify it. And what you react to in another, you strengthen in yourself. Non-reaction to the ego in others is one of the most effective ways not only of going beyond ego in yourself, but also of dissolving the collective human ego. But you can only be in a state of non-reaction if you can recognize someone's behavior as coming from the ego, as being an expression of the collective human dysfunction. When you realize it's not personal, there's no longer a compulsion to react as if it were. By not reacting to the ego, you will often be able to bring out the sanity in others, which is the unconditioned consciousness as opposed to the conditioned. At times, you may have to take practical steps to protect yourself from deeply unconscious people. This you can do without making them into enemies. Your greatest protection, however, is being conscious. Somebody becomes an enemy if you personalize the unconsciousness that is the ego. Non-reaction is not weakness, but strength. Another word for non-reaction is forgiveness. To forgive is to overlook, or rather to look through. You look through the ego to the sanity that is in every human being as his or her essence. The ego loves to complain and feel resentful not only about other people, but also about situations. What you can do to a person, you can also do to a situation. Make it into an enemy. The implication is always, this should not be happening. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be doing this. I'm being treated unfairly. And the ego's greatest enemy of all is, of course, the present moment, which is to say, life itself. Complaining is not to be confused with informing someone of a mistake or deficiency so that it can be put right. And to refrain from complaining doesn't necessarily mean putting up with bad quality or behavior. There is no ego in telling the waiter that your soup is cold and needs to be heated up, if you stick to the facts, which are always neutral. How dare you serve me cold soup? That's complaining. There is a me here that loves to feel personally offended by the cold soup and is going to make the most of it, a me that enjoys making someone wrong. The complaining we are talking about is in the service of the ego, not of change. Sometimes it becomes obvious that the ego doesn't really want change so that it can go on complaining. See if you can catch, that is to say, notice, the voice in the head, perhaps in the very moment it complains about something, and recognize it for what it is. The voice of the ego, no more than a conditioned mind pattern of thought. Whenever you notice that voice, you will always realize that you are not the voice, but the one who is aware of it. In fact, you are the awareness that is aware of the voice. In the background, there is the awareness. In the foreground, there is the voice, the thinker. And this way, you are becoming free of the ego, free of the unobserved mind. The moment you become aware of the ego in you, it is, strictly speaking, no longer the ego, but just an old conditioned mind pattern. Ego implies unawareness. Awareness and ego cannot coexist. The old mind pattern or mental habit may still survive and recur for a while because it has the momentum of thousands of years of collective human unconsciousness behind it. But every time it is recognized, it is weakened. As I said earlier in the article about this being Oprah's 110th book club pick, The book is called A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle. $10 at Amazon and $18 at Macy's. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Here are some book suggestions for most anticipated books of 2025. This one is called The Girls Who Grew Big by Leila Motley. That name is spelled L-E-I-L-A, and the last name M-O-T-T-L-E-Y. The second novel from the author of Oprah's 96th book club pick, Night Crawling, published when Motley was just 19 years old, follows a group of outcast teenage mothers in rural Florida as they grapple with love, loss, friendship, and self-discovery. The town's scorn for these girls is relentless, but so is their fierce commitment to one another. And the book, The Girls Who Grew Big, is $28 at Amazon right now. Another suggestion is Victorian Psycho by Virginia Fieto, and that's spelled F-E-I-T-O. Despite her violent compulsions, Winifred Naughty, soon to be played by Margaret Qualley, is a feature film adaptation already in the works. Arrives at the Ensor House in Grim Wolds, England, determined to be the Victorian Mary Poppins. But when the kids she's governessing turn out to be capital B brats, the dad won't stop leering at her, and the mom's jealousy turns vicious. Winifred hatches a plan to give the family exactly what they deserve on Christmas morning. This book will be the bloody belle of the 2025 literary ball. Pre-order now and you'll have the satisfaction of saying, oh yeah, I already read that one, and the serenity of knowing you can go online without encountering spoilers. The book Victorian Psycho is $12 at Amazon. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.